Reporting on the games you love by people who love to game. The MMO Reporter Network.
You're listening to the Happy Hearthstone. This show is brought to you by Doghouse Systems, who make some of the most powerful gaming PCs around and have awesome customer service from my own experience. Use the coupon code MMOREPORTER at doghousesystems.com and get a free 120GB SSD on top of the 1TB hard drive that comes with your system. By Audible, hands down, the best audiobook service in the entire universe. Seriously, if you have any sort of commute or just prefer to listen to your books, you've got to check Audible out. Go to audibletrial.com/MMOREPORTER and get a free 1 month trial and a free audiobook. If you'd like to directly support this show and the nice people who make it, you can find more information at gamediplomat.com/donate. Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Happy Hearthstone Podcast, the longest running Hearthstone podcast in the history of space and time and cards. I'm your host, Josh Augustine, and this week I'm joined by none other than the most requested guest host of all time on any show ever, Scott Lance.
Hi, everybody.
Wait, that's not Scott Lance. That's a sort of like hillbilly cousin of Scott Lance.
This is Scott Lance's hillbilly cousin.
That's cool. Yeah. I could dig it. So we couldn't get Scott Lance, but we got the next closest thing. He says he's heard of Hearthstone, so that's probably good enough.
I've played it once or twice.
All right. So in case you guys are new to the show or don't remember, Scott Lance has been on the show a bunch. Bunch of winning decks. He's also led a lot of our best strategy episodes, which is what we're doing again this week. What? Brace your brains. It's new info coming straight to you across the internet. Make you smart. Let's talk about why we're happy, Scott. Why are you happy?
Why am I happy? Yeah. I am happy that it seems like you and I have talked and you're going to let me be on the show a little more often.
I know. It's crazy. So just how often?
Well, I think the plan is for me to be on about once a month. You're still planning on doing the deck battle episodes, and then I think between those, I'll come on and have some strategy topics to talk about.
Yeah, throw down some wisdom.
Yep, including a new format, possibly, that we're going to experiment with this time, and maybe even get your listeners a little more involved. That'll be fun.
Yeah, we love getting listeners involved here at the Happy Hearthstone. It's one of our favorite things. Yeah, so Scott will be coming on once a month, throwing down some enlightenment with some strategy tips and all that sort of good stuff. And then we'll still try and do a deck battle episode in between that, also once a month. So I'll be alternating every 2 weeks with that sort of stuff. So we can get both sides in there. So it'll be great. I am happy because I went farming today, Scott. I secretly kind of want to be a farmer, but after today I realized that a farmer requires way too much work, and I'm just not cut out for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be happy after a day of farming, but I'm glad you can find peace and tranquility in that.
I can. It was nice. It was nice until someone almost put a huge steel stake through their eyeball.
What?
And then I was like, this is dangerous stuff. Yeah, we're using, I don't know the right words, but we're trying to put like these large steel poles into the ground to string tomato-like lines through. And we're using, like, this is really weird. It's like basically a hammer, but you actually, like, encase part of the post. It's like a post hammer sort of thing. Clearly I'm not cut out to be a farmer. But anyways, as he was doing that, the top piece of it snapped off. So that he was, like, throwing his whole body into putting it up and down and then just went straight through. His head flew forward, hit along the steel pole, and cut a huge gash in his eyebrow.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was just like, wow, like, it was the guy, I handed it off to him, and I was like, it's your turn, because we were alternating, and then this happened to him. I was like, I almost killed that man. So I'm glad he is not dead.
Welcome, everybody, to the horrifying Hearthstone.
Yeah, with spooky tales of farming. Not what you expected this week, I'm sure.
Wow.
All right. Also not what I expected this week, Scott. Let's talk about some news real fast.
Yeah.
The new expansion was given a release date for next Thursday. What?
So awesome.
Yeah, like, I knew this was coming fast, but this was even faster than I was expecting. And I like that they did it the day after April Fool's, so we didn't have to wonder if it was all a trick.
Right. Yeah, you gotta give them credit. They've been turning stuff around pretty fast, and when they've been saying a month, you know, they hold off on announcing things till they're close, but they say a month, and it's the last two times it's been at the beginning of the month. That's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. So don't forget, you can still pre-order Black Rock Mountain, the Adventure Pack, in the store right now. If you do, it's $25. You can't pre-order with gold. Wah, wah, that makes me sad. But if you do, you get an exclusive card back, which looks pretty sweet. It's got molten lava and it's moving around. Are you going to pre-order for this pack or this card back, Scott? Are you going to wait?
I already pre-ordered. And I did a cost breakdown analysis of how much of what the, let's see, the gold to cash ratio is for all the different things that you can buy, arena runs, packs, and I looked at the different thresholds of packs from the least efficient SKUs to the most efficient SKUs, as well as Naxxramas and Black Rock Mountain, because the pricing on those are identical to each other. And it turns out that if you're the kind of person that ever puts money in the game or you're willing to put money in the game, buying these sets with money is by far the most economical thing that you can do with your cash. If you instead spend your cash on packs and arena run and spend your gold on this, you are flushing value down the toilet.
See, Scott, this is why I love having you on the show. I ask you an innocent question, just wondering, and you hit back me with like spreadsheets and math. Because I'm just like, my answer would be like, no, I'm going to spend gold on it because I think that's great. And you're like, well, let me tell you about this. I have done extensive research. I actually did my PhD in Black Rock Mountain pre-ordering.
It's funny because I saw some folks saying they were going to order it with gold, and it got me to thinking. And I'm just that kind of nerd. So I actually did the math on all the different SKUs in the store and the ratios of. It turns out that buying packs and buying arena runs are, for the most part, about as cost efficient. They're pretty interchangeable. You're not really incentivized to do one over the other. But if you're ever going to drop money on the game, these sets are the time to do it. And it means if you pre-order with that money that you know you were going to pay to buy this anyway, then hey, you get that card back. Do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. If you're gonna pay for this all, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's cheaper to buy all the wings together than try and buy them separately later, right?
Because I think they're charging $7 a piece individually, or if you buy at least two of the wings together, you get them for $5 a piece. And the reason I word it like that is it's conceivably possible that you could buy a couple of wings with whatever gold you have sitting around and then pay cash for the rest, and it'll prorate them down to $5 a piece as long as you're buying more than one wing.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. But I honestly, again, if you're going to pay any cash, if you can afford the $25, don't spend $25 on packs. Spend $25 on this. Save your gold for packs.
Boom. There you go. Strategy from Scott.
Yeah. It's actually about 67% more effective.
Really? I would not have guessed that high.
It was, let's see. Yeah, it's going to take me a minute to bring up the numbers, but I did crunch them and I was surprised by it wasn't even close.
Okay, maybe I'll have to pre-order then. I thought I was doing the smart thing using my gold, but clearly not.
Nah, it was around like 1.0x for the packs and whatever, and it was like 1.6 or 1.7x for the adventure sets.
Okay.
Enough of that. Enough nerdery
nice.
For All the moment.
So let's talk about other math in the set, which is the more fun math, if you ask me. The cards. So they revealed a bunch of new cards. We don't want to talk about all of them because we're going to be doing a review in the future and all that. But let's talk about just our favorites that got revealed. I'll go first. My favorite that I saw was Nefarian, of course, because he's like, if dragons were rogues, he would be the rogue, and that's why I love him. I think he's a black dragon. Ooh, all mysterious. So he has a 9-cost dragon minion with 8/8 as stats. Pretty weak for that 9-cost, because 9 is expensive. But battle cry, add 2 random spells to your hand from your opponent's class, not their deck, but their class. And I love cards like this that let you do combos and stuff that you just otherwise cannot do in this game.
Mm-hmm.
This is just such a cool card.
Yeah, and it's interesting being from their class. It's hard to figure out how to take advantage of that in any way, but it is interesting because you're kind of using their tools against them, sort of.
Yeah, it's weird because a lot of times when you're using like the priest card that do similar stuff, like, okay, you figured out their control hunter. You kind of know what type of card you're going to get, but this is just like, nope, give me any one of their spells. And some classes have pretty bad spells.
Yeah. Now, you know, Thought Steal from the priest, right?
Yeah.
Steals 2 cards from your opponent's deck. I have noticed, and I'm absolutely convinced that this is a thing, even though it's not written officially anywhere, that it prefers their class cards to the neutral cards. And on average, class cards tend to be more powerful, and certainly outside of your own deck. So that's, you know, a bonus too. But they pick the class-specific cards over the neutral cards most of the time. It's not that you'll never get a neutral, but if you pay attention, it's highly disproportionate that you get class-specific cards from Thoughtsteal.
Huh. So have you run math on this?
I have not, like, written down and crunched the numbers, but I've played so many games, and the first time it occurred to me, I started paying attention every time I saw a Thoughtsteal cast or that I cast it myself, and it overwhelmingly seems to be class-specific cards that come out of that.
Interesting. All right.
Which makes Thoughtsteal a little better than it seems like.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it does mean that Thoughtsteal is similar in a lot of ways to Nefarian's Effect.
Yeah, but much cheaper, obviously.
Yeah, it also doesn't have an 8/8 body attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And available to non-priests. It is a neutral minion.
Yeah, and, you know, there is this set does give you some incentive to hold on to Nefarian and not feel bad about the fact that he's so expensive, because there are so many cards that reward you for having a dragon in your hand when you play him.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So it's hard to tell how much it's going to be worth. I've been pretty unimpressed when I've looked at them, and I don't know that having Nefarian in your deck, you know, makes all those seemingly bad cards worth it, but it is a step.
So looking at all the cards we've seen so far, we're getting off topic, I know. Do you expect there to be, like, dragon versions of every class, like there is a mech version of every class? Or is it just going to be kind of like Naxx, where it's just they're good cards that'll probably get sprinkled in there?
Yeah, they can't possibly go as deep as they did on Naxx. And we've already seen a lot of the class-specific cards, and I don't know that any of the class-specific cards have dragon, you know, subtypes or mechanics in them.
Yeah.
A couple of them have, like, dragon in the name, I think, but it doesn't have any effect. And we've got some dragons in the game now. Most of them aren't great. Azure Drake is really good, but most of the other ones aren't particularly great. There's a couple legendaries, of course, like Deathwing and Nyxia.
What's the Dreamer? Ysera.
Oh, Ysera, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right, what's your card?
All right, I picked the Draconid Crusher, which is kind of a funky name. This guy is a 6-cost, 6/6 dragon. So he's overcosted by half a mana, which isn't too bad. And his battle cry is, if your opponent has 15 or less health, gain +3/+3. And so I was thinking, man, this sounds fantastic to me in an aggro deck. Like, if this is a curve topper in an aggro deck, hopefully by the time you get to turn 6, if all your cards are designed to be dealing damage, then you're just dropping a 9/9 on turn 6.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a little bit of a risk, but only being half a mana off, if you're willing to treat it like a vanilla creature, it's what is it? Boulder Fist Ogre is just a 6/7 vanilla. And I would gladly trade that 1 point of toughness for, you know, at least in the decks that think it can do this, where I can get my opponents down to 15 or less health, for it to be a 9/9 instead. Like, that seems like a really good gamble. And it's a dragon, so if you've got any dragon synergy cards in your deck, then that's, you know, perhaps worth the half a mana's worth of cost you're paying as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't even have to get him down to 15 necessarily by the time you drop this, because you could drop him, and if he's at 20, if you have anything on the board or a spell in your hand, you can get him to 15 and then attack with him, too.
Well, this is a battle cry.
Oh, battle cry.
Yeah, so it does have to be when you cast it, but that's okay. I still think that if you're in a deck designed to do it, like, I haven't seen all the dragon cards, none of us have quite yet, so it's hard to say if this guy, you know, wants to be in a dragon deck, if dragon decks have that much synergy, but I think his ability synergy is so strong, and just like a hunter face deck, for example, when your hero power lets you do 2 every turn, and if you've got you know, charge minions, or if you've just got early game beast minions and you're flushing your hand to do a lot of damage, it seems highly likely that you're going to be able to get them down to 15 or less health in a deck that's intending to do just that.
Now, hold on, Scott. So I just pulled up this card just to make sure I could understand it after getting that wrong. This dude is not a dragon. What is this guy?
Yeah, he's like a humanoid dragon or something.
Yeah, he's like leaping through the air. He looks like a barbarian or something.
It's a draconid.
This guy is weird. I do not want him in my deck. I'm sorry, Scott.
It is weird that he's a humanoid of type dragon.
Yeah. Are dragons breeding with humans? Is that even possible? That doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
What unholy union are you promoting on this show?
Look, man, what happens in behind Black closed Rock doors? Mountain. Yeah, what happens in Black Rock Mountain stays in Black Rock Mountain.
That's fair. What freaky dwarves in there. All right. So this week, we are doing a strategy potluck. Alternative name was strategy smorgasbord, which had better alliteration, but didn't actually make sense. So we're doing potluck. This is our first time doing it. Scott, this was actually your idea. So do you want to kind of explain what you were thinking about it?
Yeah, sure. So Josh and I were originally kicking around that we had a bunch of show ideas, and some of them just, they were nice things to talk about, but they didn't seem like they could carry a whole episode by themselves, and it seemed like a shame to just let those go. So we thought about, well, what if we had like a strategy episode of mini strategies, you know, that we just pile together. But then it occurred to me that, hey, I know your listeners like to write in with ideas. Why don't we solicit ideas from you, the listeners? So please write in with things that you'd like us to discuss, and we'll throw them on these episodes as opportunity allows, as they pile up, and we'll throw in our own ideas. And that's what I like calling it, a potluck, because the idea of a potluck is everybody contributes, everybody gets to sample each other's contributions, and you all sort of walk away better off than if you just made dinner for yourself.
Yeah. Unless it's one of those bad potlucks where everyone just brings salads and stuff, yeah. And there's really no meal. But we're going to avoid that, right? Listeners, you're going to be bringing in some meaty stuff for us to talk about, I hope.
Yeah, hope so.
So we're doing the first one free. You didn't have to bring anything to this episode. You just have to enjoy and think about what you're going to bring next time. And one of the big things is I don't know the right way to say this. I mean, we're not tied down to like, oh, it needs to be a revolutionary new idea strategy that no one has ever thought of. I mean, you'll see with just the topics we pick up, sometimes it's just about a deck we're having fun with. And I mean, it's something like, hey, you should try this deck because it's a lot of fun. Terms and stuff like that. So you don't have to be like a strategy mastermind to contribute. We just want kind of, it's talking points, right? Let's start with an opinion about something and then talk about it for a bit and see what we think.
Yeah, or even a question possibly. I mean, that's kind of like the email segment you've always had. But and we may or may not agree with what you say, but we'll certainly talk about it and see where we stand on it.
Yeah, absolutely. We are willing to debate anything.
That's right.
Anything. Ask us anything, please. All right, so let's kick this off with our first strategy, which is mine. Scott, today I have brought, for Scott and listeners, my strategy advice: don't overextend when you are ahead. This is one I had to learn recently, so I thought I would share with everyone. It's really tempting when you have cool cards in your hand and you have a ton of mana, right? It's like turn 6, turn 7. But if you already have board control, it's better just to leave that mana open. It's okay to end the turn with 6 mana if you use your hero power and then move on. You're just setting them up for like higher value AoE, right? That's what has happened to me that made me learn this recently. I was ahead and I had already burned one of their, totally blanking, the mage 4 damage AoE.
Flame strike.
Thank you. I already burned one flame strike. So I was like, oh, they probably don't have another flame strike. And if I throw this down, I can win next turn. And so I threw it down. I threw down two more cards, then just boom, second flame strike. And suddenly I was down on board control and down on card advantage. It was painful.
Yep. Yeah.
What do you think, Scott?
So I have a hard time with this one. So first of all, there's absolutely truth to what you're saying. Absolutely. The question is how far to take it. Because I think that you could point out just as many instances where you were ahead and you're like, well, I don't want to overreach here. So then you keep things in your hand and then they do some sort of board reset and then they get a lead on you. And then suddenly you have a hard time reestablishing control. So I guess I would put an asterisk next to it and say, this is always something you should be cognizant of. But under different circumstances, I think you can expose yourself to different risk. And here's what I mean by that. So if you're playing a mage, you need to fear Flamestrike. And I think playing mages is a good place not to overextend too much, because Flamestrike will wipe out most things that you drop down. But if you're playing a paladin, the only thing you really have to worry about from an AoE perspective, there's Avenging Wrath, which really won't, the more creatures you have, the less impact it has on any given creature. So that's actually the way you mitigate that is by dropping more creatures. And then Consecrate, right? And the same thing with Hunters. It's was it Flame Trap is really what you have to worry
about. Explosive Trap.
Yeah. Or Explosive, I'm sorry, Explosive Trap. Yeah, the two damage to everything. So with those two classes, I try to be very careful about filling the board only with two toughness creatures or two health creatures. But if I have like a 3-4 or something, or if I have a Sludge Belcher, I'll go ahead and drop that down because I know that it's probably not going to go away with their AoE. It may get dinged a little, but you know it's still going to be around and it's still going to allow me to have some forward momentum. Sacrificing your forward momentum is, in my mind, a risk in and of itself. So I would say, I think maybe a way of wording it is don't be afraid to extend your lead, but don't, you know, not necessarily overextending, especially if the class that you're fighting against has a lot of punch. But if you're playing Mage and Constructed and you've seen, you know, say one Flame Strike and you're only on turn 7, the odds that they're going to have drawn that second Flame Strike are remarkably low. So you might actually be safe to just flush your hand.
Yeah. And yeah, I think you're right. I think it has a lot to do with, the class you're playing against, and also the class or how you're trying to win, right? So if you're trying to win through late game board control, right, just wait them out, maybe you don't need to push your advantage. But if you're trying to win through tempo, right, maybe you do, because, well, if you don't kill them in a couple turns, you're probably going to lose anyway, so you have to go all in.
Yeah, that's a very good call. For aggro and probably even mid range, I think you have to keep that pressure up. But if you're more the control player, then really what you want to do is, first and foremost, I would say make sure that you've got enough on the board to maintain board control. And if you want to hold some stuff back for a rainy day to make sure that you can keep applying that pressure, even if there's a board reset of some sort, that does make a lot of sense to me.
Okay. Now, I'm going to throw in strategy tip 1.5, which is a question for you, Scott, because it's been driving me crazy lately, and I can't figure out what to do. All right. So, turn one, when it comes to me, the mage is going to have turn two next, right? So they're going to have their hero power up next turn. Do I play Clockwork Gnome?
That's tough.
To remind people, sorry, it's a 2/1 that when it dies, I get a spare part in my hand.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is you're making them spend their turn two on it. But the thing is, your spare parts, not even really worth half a card, but let's just call it half a card. That's being generous. You're down half a card for that exchange. You didn't hurt them. I actually do not. When I'm playing a mage in that scenario, I do tend to keep my one toughness minions, at least that are cards from out of my hand. Like, I'll play the paladin one, sure. Like, we'll just trade hero powers at that point. But if I'm playing a mage, I do tend to keep the one toughness minions in my hand, and I generally only play them when there's other options beside them. It's like, sure, you can take this guy out, but then you have to ignore everything else, or we're a little deeper in the game, and if on turn 4, instead of casting a Fireball or a Chillwind Yeti, you're casting like a 2-mana cost creature to kill my Clockwork Gnome, okay, I'm comfortable with that. But if you're putting that thing out and you know that they can just burn their turn 2 profitably killing it, then you're just like starting the game with them being half a step ahead of you, and that doesn't feel right to me.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. I wasn't sure, if the trade-off of, oh, well, they didn't play their Knife Juggler, like if that sort of, I don't know if that's board control or not, if that actually helps long-term or not.
It's hard to say. They can still play their Knife Juggler down the road. And in fact, if they've got a deck where they want Knife Juggler on the board, they're probably pretty happy to play it on turn 4 where they can play something else on the same turn.
Oh, that's true.
Right. And still get that dagger. So I don't really think it's that much of a disservice. You've just sort of, A, you've started off half a step behind them, and B, you've sort of pushed the game to where there's more mana and where they're probably a little more happy to be anyway.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Sweet. Thank you. That just came up, so I'm tossing it in. There you go. Yeah. That's how potlucks work. Surprise. All right. What's your strategy?
All right. So this one's got kind of a nerdy title, but I said understand and control variants. So
nerd.
Yeah, it's true.
just kidding.
the big question up front is, what the heck is variance? That's just randomness, right? And the thing is, it's not. It's not randomness. Randomness and variance are kind of related, but they are different. So randomness is, I'm going to roll a six-sided die, and it's going to have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. Variance is sort of the quality of maybe having randomness to it. So it's really about how different the outcomes will be the more times you do something. If there's not, if the outcome tends to be the same every time, then you would say that has low variance. And if the outcome tends to be like wildly swingy every time, you would say that it has high variance. So, you know, Miracle Road deck is something that jumps to my mind, where if all the pieces come together and they can execute that combo, things go really, really well for them. But it requires them to have drawn a bunch of cards in order to fire that off, and it doesn't always happen. So there's a lot of games when they just can't quite get where they need to be, and they just get steamrolled. And so they tend to win big or lose big. They don't tend to kind of perform steadily in every game. Yeah. So given that that's what high and low variance is, why do we care about it? Well, some interesting things. One, if you're in a position where you think that you are better than your opposition, you think on average you're going to win for whatever reason, then you actually want low variance. I in my mind, I sort of envision, you know, those old I forget what they're called, but they like can analyze like signals or something. They're just these wavy lines, like a sine wave or something, right? And you always see the scientist in the movies that turns the dial and it makes the sine wave get bigger or smaller, or they can flatten it to a line. So the way I look at it is like there's my line and there's my opponent's line. And if I'm better, or if, actually let's say if they're better, if they're above me, then I want those lines to go up and down a lot, because my line is more likely to be above there some of the time. Whereas if they turn the knob all the way down and the lines are flat, well, then they're always above me and they're always going to beat me. And so that says that if in some ways that if you don't feel that you're the best player or have the best cards, but you're competing with people that you feel like for whatever reason might be a little out of your league, then you actually may want to go with high variance decks. That means cards and decks with maybe more combos or more random potential, things that don't always work, but when they work, they tend to work well. Because while you still may not get a 50% win rate out of it, you may actually get more wins than you would otherwise get with sort of the slow and steady, constantly performing deck. So the inverse of that is that if you think that for whatever reason you're discernibly above average, like say if you're a kind of player that gets up into the like single digits in ranked every month when you put your mind to it, but you're starting the month into low teens and you want to quickly move up the ladder, then you probably actually want a slow and steady deck that's pretty consistent, because that means you're more likely to consistently win during that time period.
So what decks would you consider low variance? Because I can think of Miracle Rogue as high variance. Is that the only high variance one too?
No, I think the combo decks tend to be more high variance, because if you've got a deck that requires on you drawing three cards, and then when you draw those three cards, you win, but if you don't, you don't, well, then you're sort of playing a probability game, right? You're not, it's just, can I live long enough to get all three of these cards? But I would argue aggro decks tend to be pretty low variance, because they don't rely on combos. They're pretty consistent. Like when I build when I'm really going just all out aggro, the mentality that I'm using when I put a card in my deck is everything I put in should do about 3 or preferably more points of damage pretty deterministically. And so that means if I start the game with 3 cards in my hand, that's, you know, like 9 to 12 damage right there. And every card I draw, you know, whether it's a charge minion or a direct damage spell, or it's amplifying a minion that I've been able to keep on the board already. You know, so a lot of times an aggro deck is going to win or lose by, say, turn 7 or 8 or whatever, because it's so constant what it's doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those are just examples.
Interesting.
And it's a complicated subject, and it's murky. And it's not like, I don't think it's going to be revolutionary for anybody, but it is a topic to think about when you're building your deck. Because if you notice that, if you think your deck is good, but you notice that it's like, I don't know, sometimes you just win big or lose big, you may actually want to look for the cards or maybe the combos that you're sort of reliant on there. And you might have more success by tuning down or even up your variance by removing or adding, say, randomness to your deck.
Interesting. Okay, so something like the Paladin combo, Quartermaster and Muster for Battle, or something is kind of a, would you consider that a high variance then, because you need to draw both those cards?
Yeah, it's certainly approaching that side of the spectrum. If you've got a deck full of stuff like Chillwind Yetis, then that's going to be a pretty, you know what to expect out of that turn over turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, very cool. I feel like the strategy was directed at me, Scott, for when we duel. You're telling me that I should do some high variance decks.
Well, know what I'm saying? That's not where I was going with that, but that is a strategy that you could use.
I think I may try that. I'm gonna just throw in all the Mad Bombers and just see what happens.
So here's another quick way of illustrating that. If you're playing somebody that you think is better than you, then anything that you can do to make the game an even coin flip to bring it to, like, say, a 50-50 level, if that person would otherwise beat you, say, 75% of the time, then adding things that make the game a toss-up are more in your favor, right? And that again, yeah, just illustrates that if you feel you're at an inherent disadvantage, you may want to crank up the variance. If you feel like you're at an advantage, you may want to crank down the variance. And I don't want to get too deep on this topic, but it may even make sense to try to watch for opportunities to tune the variance up or down during a given game as well. But yeah, that's a topic for another day.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you don't want to bring full meals to the potluck, Scott. So that was a good side dish. All that right. was good.
Which you right, got
my
next
one, I have brought a card. So, I was trying to phrase that as if it were a potluck, but it just was not working. So bear with me. This is a new format. My strategy is kind of like a tip, I guess. I really like bringing at least one card that can heal minions in most of my decks. And this could be my playstyle, Scott, so I'm interested to hear your counterpoint on this. Being able to heal a minion is still, I mean, it's very unexpected. There really aren't a ton of cards that do it, especially if you're looking for minions that do it. I think there's only two, the Earthen Ring Farseer and the Darkscale Healer. But there are obviously a lot of spells that do it, like Holy Light, the Paladin mm-hmm. one, mm-hmm. Ancestral Healing from the Shamans as well. To me, I think the element of surprise that it brings is super valuable, because a lot of times players, you know, you're making trades and planning out, and when they play their minions, they do it based on what minions you have on the board, what their health totals are, thinking that they can force you into a good trade for them. And so pulling this out and being like, oh, that, you know, the injured Chillwind Yeti doesn't have 2 life, he's back at 5 life, and he can trade again and trade again before he goes down. I don't know. It seems like it could be pretty useful in aggro as well, just to help your dudes keep punching face for another turn. Just keeps them more alive than they would be. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I do agree with most of that. In aggro decks, I think the big problem is your minions tend to be like cheaper charge minions a lot of the time, and so they don't. There's nothing to heal if they, you know, have like yeah. 1 or 2 health. Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I also think of buff cards as being very similar, because when you're buffing a unit, you're inherently healing it as well.
Yeah.
With however much, you know, additional health, maximum health you're giving it its current health as well. But healing tends to be a lot more cost efficient than buffing it. So that's an upside. Earthen Ring Farseer, for example, when you're paying only half a mana, because it's a 3/3 for 3. Normally you would expect a 3/4 with, it's like that spider tank, I think, is a 3/4 yeah. mech for 3. And that's right on the vanilla curve. So 3/3 for 3, you're half a mana off. But healing 3 is great. And it's hard to know exactly how to look at it. But in a way, if you've got, let's just say you've got a Chillwind Yeti on the board. You know, it's a 4/3. If they've set up the board so that you didn't have any good trades with it, or that, you know, the next time it gets hit by something that's going to die, you add 3 more health to it. It's kind of sort of like making it a 4/3 for half a mana. Now, it's yeah. not really that good, and it's hard to explain. I can't figure out where it would actually lie, but it certainly is a lot better than half a mana.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying there. You're saying that 3 stat points, essentially, on the Chillwind Yeti, which is what you heal it for, is worth 1.5 mana.
Well, yeah, I guess what I was saying is, if you were in a situation where the Chillwind Yeti would otherwise die, but you gave it 3 more health, then you sort of created a 4/3 where there wouldn't have been a 4/3. You see what I'm saying?
Gotcha. Yeah.
And I know that's a weird way of looking at it, but it's a way of looking at it, and I don't think it's totally true on the surface. I'm not saying that you play Earthen Ring Farseer, and then for half the mana of premium you're paying for his ability, you're getting suddenly a 4/3 out of that. But there's an element of truth to that, and I think it certainly represents a lot more value in the right scenario than just the half mana. So that to me is where healing tacked onto certain cards can be super effective. I think Earthen Ring Farseer and Darkscale Healer are both highly cost efficient, and you can do really, really good things with them. Ancestral Healing, that's like a pure healing card, if I'm not mistaken. And pure healing cards.
It restores a minion to full health and gives it taunt.
Yeah.
It's not a great card.
Yeah. The full healing or pure healing, and even just like the slight buff of taunt, it doesn't really do it for me.
Yeah, it is zero mana, but it is still a card slot. Hey, it's better than Totemic Might.
Everything is better than Totemic Might.
Man, I have a gold version of that. I should really just dust it. It's just sitting there taunting me. Yeah. Maybe someday you'll want this.
Oh, man. No. Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. All right, that's my strategy. What you got?
All right. So I was going to, following my true nerd form, I'm going to dive into some numbers here, talk very quickly. This isn't going to be too bad. Just going to talk about the odds of drawing cards and combos. So this is mostly to make sure that people are, A, thinking about the odds of drawing combos if they're going to build their deck around a combo, that they should understand what they're getting themselves into. And then secondarily, I wanted to talk very briefly about how people can use a tool to understand the probabilities themselves if they're so inclined. But just to poke at some numbers really quickly, if you are throwing a card in your deck and it's sort of important to your deck concept and you want to understand what the odds of drawing it is, clearly adding two copies to your deck is better than one. And by extension, that does mean that non-legendaries do have an advantage that way. If it's important to the concept of your deck that you draw a given card, then if that effect is a legendary, you're only going to have one in your deck. And when it comes down to it, unless you're a control deck, you're often not going to draw that one card in your deck during any given game. So I didn't want to crunch a ton of numbers and bore everybody. So let's just talk about, by the time you've drawn half your deck, I think a lot of decks and a lot of games, the games are ending about the time that you've ripped through half your deck, through your opening hand, at a number of turns passing, and maybe a draw spell or two. You may, by the end of the game, have gone through half your deck. So let's just use that as an assumption. If you've got a single legendary in your deck or just one copy of a card, you've got a strict 50% chance of drawing it. If you've got two, it's actually a lot better. It's a 76% chance of drawing that card after you've drawn 15 cards. So that shows that if it's important to you, you want to give yourself every advantage that you can and put in two copies. This is actually at the heart of why when people put a card in their deck, they tend to include two copies if they feel that it's important. You know, that's even in Magic where you can have four copies of a card, they tend to do the same thing. Now, more interestingly, let's talk about the chances of getting a two-card combo. After 15 cards, if you've just got, let's say that we're looking at a Quality and Consecrate, because a lot of people tend to put that in their Paladin decks, and a lot of people tend to rely on it, and they'll complain if they don't get their Quality and Consecrate. So what are the odds after 15 cards have been drawn? Is 57% chance that you'll have drawn at least one each of a Quality and Consecrate. That may sound pretty high, but keep in mind that's kind of by the end of the game in a lot of cases. Maybe not control on control where they're going to take each other to fatigue, but assuming that either deck is sort of mid-range or aggro, then that's probably going to push the game to be a little faster paced. And that means that by the end of that game, you have roughly a 57% chance of having drawn one instance of that combo. So, okay.
I mean, that's barely above half of your games.
That's right. And that's not to say that you're going to have it at your disposal the entirety of those games. It's at some point during that game, it's going to have come up. And in fact, the odds go up every turn that passes. Every turn that passes, you are more likely to complete that combo than the turn before. So it's not to say that like halfway to turn, you know, to the point where you've drawn 15 cards, that it's half that probability. It's actually way less than half. The odds go up, it sort of accelerates every turn. There's a different type of combo from just a Quality and Consecrate, and that's when you start having parts of the combo be a legendary. So an example could be Blingtron, which is a legendary, and an acidic swamp ooze. So you play the Blingtron, you give you and your opponent a weapon, and then you play the acidic swamp ooze to destroy your opponent's weapon, and you're left with a weapon. So that's pretty cool. The odds of that happening is only 37% chance to draw the one Blingtron you need and in one of the copies of acidic swamp ooze. And that's 37% that half, or you know, when you're halfway through your deck, you're going to have gotten that combo, which is pretty low. And then a variation of that combo that people really like is Blingtron and Harrison Jones. Well, now you're talking about two legendaries, and that's a super cool combo. But after 15 turns, you're only 24% likely to have drawn both of those. And then something else to keep in mind, that 15, you know, I keep basing that on 15 cards. And of course, you can look at any number of cards and the numbers change. But aggro decks will tend to draw fewer cards. And that means that combos, because you're drawing fewer cards in an aggro deck, you can count on combos much less in an aggro deck. Whereas in a controlled deck, if your deck is built to play the long game and you plan on seeing the majority of your deck over the course of that game, then actually these combos are a lot more safer because every turn that passes, your odds go up significantly of drawing that combo. So you wouldn't necessarily have to feel so bad about Blingtron and Harrison Jones if you're in a controlled deck. If you're willing to bide your time, then by the end of the game, you will. Obviously, by the time you're all the way through that deck, you will have drawn that combo.
Yeah, and man, the scariest thing about those numbers is that, like you said, that's by the time, you know, you've drawn 15 cards, and you have to hope that you haven't had to play one of those cards
along
the way,
because
sometimes you can't wait for acidic swamp ooze or Harrison Jones.
Yep. Yeah, so to me, there's a little bit of a cautionary tale in there that says, I think people put too much emphasis on combos. I think that they expect them to be drawn more often than they are. I think they, you know, throw their hands up in frustration, like, why didn't I draw it? And they feel almost entitled to it. And it's actually, no, when you look at the numbers tell you that it's oftentimes more the exception than the rule that you're going to get those. The one place where I think it's safer to assume that you will draw it and you will be able to play it is if you're A, in a controlled deck, and B, that you're making commitment to not play those cards. And that's, to me, Miracle Rogue is the epitome of this. That wasn't just two card combos, those were multi-card combos, but they had a bunch of cards in their deck that were dedicated to biding time. And then there were the cards in their deck that were part of the combo that the intention was that they were just going to hold on to them and only play them when they had the combo set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, like you said earlier, that's a very high variance deck.
That's right.
I mean, that you just can't get those combos all the time.
Yep. That's right. And then, so if anybody wants to know how I got those numbers, there's a thing called a hyper geometric calculator. And I just became aware of this myself recently. I've started hanging out with some more Magic nerds than I used to, and I mean that in the most complimentary way. And these guys are seriously high-end good players. And hypergeometric calculators, you can find one online at deculator.appspot.com. That's deculator.appspot.com.
And we'll have a link in the show notes, too.
Yeah. And the reason this one's special, there's actually a bunch of these hypergeometric calculators out there, but this one was built specifically for calculating odds in Magic, but it ports, you know, completely well to Hearthstone. And what you do is you just go there and you say, you know, I've got two of these and I need to draw one, and I've got, you know, one of these and I need to draw one, and then I've got 27 other cards in my deck and I need to draw zero of those. And then you say compute, and then you tell it, you know, what turn, like, or basically how many you want to have drawn, like, that you want to know. In this case, I would use 15. And it will tell you the odds at that point that you will have gotten the combo that you defined after that many card draws.
Yeah, this is pretty crazy. There's links on here and, like, an advanced used page with so much number crunching and theory crafting and charts and graphs. This is blowing my brain out right now.
Yeah. Scott. And you don't have to do all that stuff. You know, you can just, this is how, I mean, I just use it very superficially, right? I just type in the numbers of stuff I care about and then I see how it shakes out. But again, the cautionary tale that I've walked away with is that it's generally bad to build a deck that needs those combos to be drawn in order to win. I think it's fine to have combos in your deck, but I think that you want to have so many interactions between all the things in your deck. Like, remember my Death Rattle Shaman deck. I use things like Nurubian Egg and Reincarnate that are normally very, very bad, but they're like, you know, 8 or 10 cards out of the deck combo with them, not just two. So it hardly a game goes by when I don't get what I need in order to get an effective combo.
Yeah, this is really cool. I will definitely be playing around with this. Yeah, I like how easy it is to use. All the stuff is there if I wanted to know more. Man, The Art of the Combo Warrior, it's this article. I can't even tell you how many pages. This has to be at least 40 pages.
What?
Yeah, this is crazy.
Oh, man.
That's really cool. But I like that you crunched the numbers for us, Scott, you always do. I appreciate that.
All right, what you got, Josh?
Strategy number 5, my last strategy for the day, my last contribution to today's potluck, is Demon Warlock is super fun, and you should totally try it if you hadn't already. I've just been having so much fun with this lately. There's so many fun combos. Uh-oh, there's the combos. Oh, no. But the reason I like this is all the cards combo in such cool ways together that it's not like I'm waiting for, oh, well, I need Demon Fire and I need Mistress of Pain, right? Like, that's a cool combo if I get it, but Demon Fire is also really cool with Void Terror or with, you know, Void Caller. Like, it feels like there's so much synergy that you don't need specific combos.
Yeah, I have a deck that has all of these cards that you listed as examples, has all of them, and it is a blast. Mistress of Pain and Demon Fire is one of my favorite things on this earth, and I saw in your notes you put like two hearts next to it.
Oh, yeah. It's so good when it goes off, especially if you can eat a minion the turn you play it, right? Yeah. It's just like, oh, the turn is just so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it just lets you do your life pact every single turn.
Yep.
The other one that I love is either putting Power Overwhelming either on the Nurubian Egg or on the Void Caller. And then you smash something either medium-sized or big with it, because that gives it +4/+4, but kills it at the end of the turn. But then you drop Void Terror down, which you're running because it works fine with Nurubian Egg anyways. But what Void Terror does, Battlecry, destroy the minions on either side of it. So it kills your own minions, but it gains their attack and health permanently. So you just turn that temporary 4/4 buff for one mana into a permanent 4/4 buff onto the Void Terror.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. And I love that they finally broke the, you know, Handlock and Zoo molds, because everything we're kind of falling into those two archetypes. And if you remember back to our Naxx review, when we were reviewing Void Caller, you were like, man, there's just not like enough demons. I don't care. There's not the synergy. And I said, I hear you. I agree right now, but I think in the future they're going to release more demon cards. And I think the Blizzard's trying to push a demon deck thing. And I think they're setting up, you know, in the future for that to be a viable archetype. And I think we're there.
Yeah, I think we are too. Absolutely. I mean, Floating Watcher is so good.
Yeah.
So just to remind people, that's the 5-cost 4/4. But whenever your hero takes damage on your turn, hey, for example, when you use your hero power, gain +2/+2. I've been running that yesterday in two games back-to-back. I got to play Dread Infernal the turn afterwards, which deals 1 damage to all other characters, which then gives it another 2/2. So it was an 8/8 the first turn I could attack with it. Or I guess actually an 8/7, because it took a damage from the Dread Infernal. But man, Void Caller, having in your hand, I'm running 2 copies of Dread Infernal, 2 copies of Floating Watcher, 1 Doom Guard. One of those is almost always in my hand by the time I have a Void Caller and I'm throwing out to die. You can get those guys, which are 6/6, 5/7, or 4/4, down on turn 3 if they trade with it and you had coin. That is just super fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I will give fair warning, though. There's one demon card that you should just not play. Because when you build a demon card or a demon deck, first thing you do is go into the little search and type in demon, because it shows you all the demon cards. And even though it's going to show you Sacrificial Pact, do not take Sacrificial Pact. 0-cost mana, I know, and the gold version looks cool. He's flipping the pages. But it's destroy a demon, restore 5 health to your hero. Never never worth it unless you're facing enemy warlock demons, but never worth it.
Right. Like, to me, that's a sideboard card when you're playing another demon deck. And right now we're in a format that doesn't support sideboards. They may someday, but right now it doesn't.
Yeah, there's just no reason. I've seen people play this card and kill their own minions to heal themselves for five heroes. Mm. And if you're at the point that that is your best option, just the resign button is closer. Just hit that.
Yeah, it's just not worth a card. I'd much rather spend six mana, destroy, you know, any minion I want, and gain three health while I'm at it. That's, yeah, to me, the better way to gain life. Or, you know, you could play Mistress of Pain and throw a...
Demon fire
on it, and then you got yourself a, what is that, even like a 6/8 lifelinker or something crazy, like a 6/9 lifelinker?
No, with only one demon fire, it's a 3/6.
Oh no, what's the +5? There's a +5/+5 variant as well.
Oh, I don't have that card.
Yeah, so GVG had, there's the +2/+2 to a demon, or 2 damage to anything, but there's a variant that does +5/+5.
Oh,
or 5
Demon
damage.
Heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Demon Heart on a Mistress of Pain. That's what I actually thought you were talking about. That is amazing.
I may have to craft that. That's only epic. I can probably do that.
And I mean, yeah, you know, it's crazy. 5 damage in a pinch. 5 targeted damage.
Yeah, for only 5 cost.
Yeah.
Not bad at all.
Yeah.
All right, so I got to ask another 0.5 strategy, 5.5. What do you feel about Corruption? So that's the 1 cost mana spell for warlocks that is, choose an enemy minion at the start of your turn, destroy it. So they get a turn knowing that it's going to die.
I don't think that I've ever played that. Actually, I've played it before, like in Arena when I just had a bad choice. I'd rather just pay more for the removal and get it done. I mean, the fact that it's so cheap, I mean, what are you going to use that on turn one? No. Okay, well, if it's deeper in the game, you can do that and other stuff on your turn, and I guess that's okay. Maybe a way of looking at it is 3 mana, kill something after a turn, draw a card, you know, if you like, and take 2 damage if you pair it with your hero ability. But I'm just not too enamored with it. Typically, when you need things to die, you need to die now. A lot of times, I'd rather just take a direct damage spell, like something like Dark Bomb, because then I can place that, 3 damage or whatever it is, wherever I want, and most often just knock something out, you know, as a surprise then and there. Otherwise, what they're going to do is they might go face, but they're typically just going to trade with whatever you put it on. So all you did was, like, you didn't actually kill that creature, you just changed what they did with that creature, and you spent a whole card doing it.
Well, a lot of times you still kill it, because usually when I have... So I have one copy of my deck. I'm not really happy with it, which is why I'm asking. But it has been really useful on stuff where, like against Druid, they'll cheat out a big minion early or something. I can't trade with it.
Yeah. That's a good call. Like, for Druid ramp, it could be good.
But yeah,
it feels
in a lot
too
of decks,
sideboardy
just,
there. Yeah,
yeah, it's been a dead card in a lot of hands. So I was thinking about dropping it. So I guess I will now.
Yeah, I'd encourage dropping it.
All right, what's your last strategy?
All right, so I figured we'd just go through some quick terms. Most people probably know these terms, but if not, hey, we're teaching you something. So I'll just rip through these pretty quickly.
Yeah.
The first one is RNG. A lot of times you'll hear people talking about RNG. That stands for random number generator. And so when they say that card is 2 RNG, what they're really just saying is that card has too much randomness in it, in their opinion. Or if they're praying to the RNG gods, then they're just sort of praying to the random number generator and hope that it rolls the die, metaphorical die, in a way that is good for them. The next term I have is punch face, or, you know, hit face or go face or whatever.
Which I use all the time.
Yeah, in Hearthstone, it's really emerged as just a pretty prevalent part of the lingo. And what that means is whenever you have like a card or minion that can damage something, rather than attacking one of the creatures, it means just hitting their life total, hitting the enemy champion or hero directly. And it's usually, if you're going to quote unquote punch face, usually that means that you have switched into a mode where you are committed to lowering their life total as quickly as they can in order to kill them. Typically, you go from control mode into sort of aggro or pain face punch mode, not the other way around. Some decks like aggro just start punching face from the beginning, but control decks will typically establish control before they start punching face, so to speak. Which leads to the next term, which is board control, which is kind of the inverse of that. Board control is this idea of using your direct damage and using your minions to first clear off your opponent's side of the board and get a presence yourself. The idea being that then when they drop things onto the board, you actually can make the more economical choices as to why. And it means that you've got a bunch of sources of repeatable damage dealing. If you notice that direct damage spells tend to be pretty expensive for the damage that they deal, whereas minions can deal damage every turn if they can stay alive. So if you can get board control, then what that means is for the remainder of the game, you're likely to have some minions be alive every turn and to deal damage to them. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying board control is all about using your cards and minions to kill your opponent's minions before you start punching face. There's a term that a lot of people use called lethal. Somebody says, oh, I had lethal or I missed lethal. Lethal is the term that means that you have the deterministic ability to deal damage to your opponent enough to kill them that turn. And the reason why this is a thing is that sometimes it's almost like a puzzle to figure out how to do the most amount of damage. And sometimes people don't realize that they can actually kill their opponent. So maybe they're, you know, when they should just punch face in order to actually kill their opponent that turn, they may not see that they have that ability, and they may instead like be ramming their minions into their opponent minions or whatever, just trying to get board control, and then they may end up losing that game, or they may win later, but they sort of threw away a guaranteed win. So that also just represents a concept that every turn you should always kind of stop and look at the board first and foremost and ask yourself, can I win if I just punch face right now? And that's lethal. BM is another term. That's just short for bad manners. So if somebody says that, you know, somebody's BMing me, that means that they're just being rude to me. Maybe they're taking a really long time. Maybe they're playing unnecessary cards just to waste time or show off. Maybe they're using emotes badly. But all those are examples of BM. Top deck. So top deck is pretty straightforward. It means essentially drawing cards off the top of your deck. But it's used in two context. One is if your hand is empty, then you're sort of in top deck mode, and it just means whatever card you draw off the top of your deck, you typically play it right away, and that just means you're in top deck mode. But then there may be a case where somebody has some things in their hand, and then they draw a card, and it's like just the card they needed, and they played it, and then somebody would say that they top decked that card, as opposed to, you know, having been holding on to it and waiting for the right circumstance. And whenever you're in top deck mode, or whenever you play a card that you top deck, both situations do kind of express that luck was on your side in that case. Like if either way, if it was the thing you needed, then, you know, it could have been anything off your deck, but you happen to get the thing you need. Mulligan. Mulligan is when you trade your cards in at the beginning of the game. You started off, you know, with three or four cards. You can send some back. And that stems from Magic from back in the day. And, of course, before that, golf. But it's just sort of the concept of a do-over. I don't think it's an official game term, but it was in Magic. And they've just leveraged, the community leverages the term in Hearthstone. You may hear AoE here and there. AoE stands for Area of Effect. It's things like Flame Strike or Consecrate. It just means an ability that can hit a bunch of things at once. Term is trading. Trading is the notion of choosing to sacrifice one of your minions for one of your opponent's minions. So they could just say, you know, I traded my, I don't even know, my Chillwind Yeti for their spider tank or whatever. Typically, when somebody chooses to trade, it's because it's an efficient trade. It's because trading off something that's already been hurt to kill something bigger or a cheaper minion for something more expensive. Typically, you don't ever want to trade something that costs more for something that costs less. And then lastly, you may hear the term ping here and there. That's kind of a carryover from Magic as well, but it's just kind of this idea of dealing a single targeted point of damage to something, usually to kill it. And that's just people just say, I pinged it. So hopefully there was something in there that's of value to somebody.
Yeah. I think that's awesome. And thankfully, Scott, I think we can now say we had 16 different strategy tips on this episode now. We just did 10 of them in fast order at the end.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's awesome. All right, so that is our first strategy potluck. Hopefully it gives you an idea of kind of what we're hoping to do. But what we want to do is get these from you guys in the future. Obviously, we'll keep throwing our own in there too, but we know you guys have strategies. We know you have something you're excited about the game or what you're enjoying. We want you to kind of send it in, or like Scott said, send in questions. If you're like me and playing Demon Warlock and be like, man, should this corruption be in my deck? Send that sort of question in. We just kind of want fast topics like this that we can toss together for these sort of potluck episodes. We'll still do the full breakdown episodes as well, where we get more in depth on things and Scott crunches all sorts of numbers. But we thought it'd be fun to do these faster chunks as well.
Yeah.
So let us know what you think. If you hated the format or loved it or want to see more, that sort of thing. Cool. Let's jump to the community. The question, there is none. Send those in so we have those for next episodes. No reviews either. Wah, wah. But what we do have is a card of the week and a person that'll sing it for us.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. How is it that I forget every week? I have no idea. All right. Impromptu. Card of the week. Card of the week. This is the card of the week.
I love it. Do you want to tell us the card of the week since you sang it?
The card of the week is the Axe Flinger. I love this guy. So the Axe Flinger is a... hold on. I had it up here and now it's gone. So give me just 2 seconds.
I put it in the show notes right beneath it too.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so it's a 4-mana cost warrior minion. It is a 2/5. So it's about 1 mana overcosted for its stats, but its ability is whenever this minion takes damage, deal 2 damage to the enemy hero. So in short, I love this card. To me, getting a single activation of dealing 2 damage to the enemy hero probably makes up for that mana I've overpaid. Like I was saying, in an aggro deck, for example, not that this is an aggro card, but in an aggro deck, if every card is doing just 3 damage to the enemy hero, I'm happy. That's worth putting in the deck. This guy, unless he somehow dies without taking damage, he's guaranteed to do at least 2 damage to the enemy hero. And with 5 toughness, honestly, he's probably going to deal at least 4 damage to the enemy hero. Yeah, and if you've got a deck that's constructed to take advantage of his ability and, like, deal individual points of damage, like a Cruel Taskmaster, Inner Rage, Wild Pyromancer, Death's Bite, Unstable Ghoul, Whirlwind, on and on and on and on and on. There's all these things in the Warrior Enrage deck that wants to do 1 point of damage to, say, either an individual thing or everything that you own. Like the idea of playing a Cruel Taskmaster and targeting this guy, he would become in that case a 4/4 that would deal 2 damage to the enemy hero. That's awesome.
Yeah. This is a great card. I agree. I'm so excited for Enrage Warrior just in general. All the warrior cards I think that I've seen so far definitely seem to be pointing people towards Enrage Warrior again.
Yeah. Well, and there's some neutrals too, like Grim Patron, and I feel like there was one more as well.
Yeah, I think this guy is great. Like you said, 2/5. You're definitely going to get 1 activation out, unless they're like assassinating it. And if they're assassinating this, that's fine.
Yeah,
you paid 4 cost for that, and they paid more.
Right. There's relatively few cards that'll kill something without dealing damage to it, and I think that is a just fine risk to run.
Yeah, I agree. This card is super exciting. Man, all the Black Rock cards look really fun. And just a reminder to people, in case you forget, all the Black Rock cards, you don't have to buy packs for these. And that's the most exciting thing for me, because looking through all the Goblins versus Gnomes cards, I was really excited, but I also kind of knew in the back of my head that I probably would never own all of these cards.
Mm-hmm.
But if you buy the dungeon, if you buy the adventure pack, you're going to own all of these cards, and that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm actually getting close-ish to having all of the Classic and GVG cards.
What?
Close-ish.
That's rad.
I keep track of them in a spreadsheet. Do I have these numbers up right now? Yeah, it takes about, I think, 108,000 dust, for example. There's 108,000 dust value to complete the base set. I've got 27,000 left. In terms of actual number of cards I don't have, it's only 32 cards I don't have, and they're mostly epic and legendary. And I've flagged the ones that I care about, and you know, I almost have enough dust to just craft all the ones I care about. And it's like, I don't need the Hungry Crab or the Lore Walker Cho or the Nat Pagel. Like, I'm fine without them, you know?
Yeah. Yep. So do you think, so if you did that and you crafted all the ones you wanted, do you think you could sit there forever and not finish off the set? Or would you eventually just have to give in and just so you could say you had them all?
Oh, I'd keep chipping away at it. What I do right now is, you know, I try to do the daily quest every day. I have sunk money in the game at various thresholds. I probably put about $200, maybe $250 in the game since launch, which to me is a good value because I've played for so many hours.
Oh yeah.
But just, you know, through arena runs and just, I don't know, every week and a half or a couple weeks or something, I can probably buy 5 more packs for free at least. Maybe it's even faster than that. So I got a legendary the other day. What did I get? It was one I didn't have, and it was a decent one. I forget. It was the guy that summons like a 2/1 every time you play a card.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was called.
What's that?
Yeah, Baron Geddon, maybe?
No, Baron Geddon deals 2 damage to everyone.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, whatever it is, obviously, it's not like one I was on the edge of my seat waiting for. But it was like, oh, hey, nice. There's 1,600 dust value that I didn't have. And that was just buying the 5 free packs for the week that I could afford by playing daily quests.
Was it Hogger?
No.
Some of the 2/2?
No.
It's Illidan Stormrage.
That was him. Yep.
Here we go. 6 cost, 7/5. Whenever you play a card, summon a 2/1 Flame of Azanoth.
That's right.
He's a pretty cool lore character too.
So I figure I'll just keep chipping away at it, and I'll drop some cash here and there. But that's part of why, like, if I want to complete that set, obviously I want to do it spending the least amount of money as possible, and that's part of the reason I crunch those numbers. Is like, I'd much rather spend 10 minutes crunching numbers and figuring out the cost efficiency of something than, you know, flushing away $10 or something in a suboptimal way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for sharing those number crunching with us, guys.
Yep. Someday maybe I'll go through the really high level numbers of what it takes to complete a set for better or worse so people can know what they're in for. But the short of it is you can get if you can get the commons and the rares pretty darn easily. It's the epics and legendaries that sting.
Okay. All right. So I think that's a show.
Cool.
We're going to have full show notes along with links to all the stuff we talked about. Black Rock Mountain stuff and all that will be in there too. And the sweet, a deculator that Scott found to help you figure out the percentages of drawing certain cards in your deck. All that will be up on the blog, gamediplomat.com. Just swing by there, click Hearthstone at the top. You'll find it. I have a bit of a cold, so my apologies. My brain is broken.
Yeah, you're being a trooper.
It's good. It's a fun episode. It's a potluck. And since we all shared, that means all of you are getting sick too. You got my cold.
Oh, thanks.
No problem. As always, though, we'd love to know what you thought of the show. This format in particular, this potluck strategy format, let us know what you'd like to see on future episodes too. Like I said, Scott's going to be coming back once a month to talk strategy. So if you have questions or topics you want us to talk about, let us know. You can always contact us on Google+. We have Happy Hearthstone, a nice group there. Contact me on Twitter. I'm @JAugustine, or you can email ajosh@outlook.com, or just leave a comment directly on the blog on gamediplomat.com. Scott, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter @slants76, and they can find me on Hearthpwn. I've got a bunch of decks posted, just slants. You can look, and that's SLANTZ.
Sweet. We'll put links to those in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
Scott, thanks again for coming on, sharing some sweet strategy with all of us.
Yeah, it was fun, man. Thanks for championing through, even though you're sick.
It was worth it. It was worth it. Cool. And thanks, everyone, for listening and visiting the Happy Hearthstone and having a little fun with us. We'll see you next time.
See you guys.